podcast from geopolitics.com. We want to continue our series looking at geopolitics of the different regions of the world. So today we want to look at the Middle East. Now, the Middle East, it always seems to be on the news, from the monarchies to the oil to the war to terrorism. I think in my own lifetime, I don't really remember any period where the Middle East wasn't a big thing on the news. I was just recently checking on Amazon, and the Middle East is the most written about topic. So we want to look at it further and the geopolitics of this region and how do we make sense of it. Here to discuss this is Geopolity founder Adnan Khan. How are you keeping, Adnan?
I'm good, Yusuf. I'm good. How are you? It's been a while.
It has been a while. I feel like this is going to be a very long podcast because there's a lot to talk about with the Middle East.
I think you're right. It's probably one of the regions where there's obviously a lot of history and a lot's been happening.
Well, let's get straight into it. So, Adnan, what are the key features of the Middle East?
Okay, so four features really, I think, define the region. And, you know, if you grasp these, I think they give you a good insight into the region. The first is obviously the location. The Middle East is really on the intersection of so many different continents. So you've got Europe on one side, you've got Asia, you've got Africa. So the region's connected to three different continents, and that's what made it historically very important. It became a transit point, really, throughout much of history. So this transit was overland, and it was also via the sea routes as well. So if you wanted to go from north to south, or east to west, or west to east, you had to traverse the Middle East. So this made the region very important, really, from that perspective. You mentioned in the introduction that the Middle East is always in the news. Well, one of the reasons it's always in the news is the region has been endowed with energy resources, fossil fuels. So oil was first discovered in this region in the late 1800s and the early 1900s. So in 1900, oil was discovered in Iran. Iran at the time became one of the largest oil producers in the world. Then Saudi, Bahrain and Qatar in the 1930s, they discovered oil and they came online. And then in the 1950s, you had Oman and the UAE. So if I remember, I think at least 5 or 6 of the top 10 oil producers are in the Middle East. I think more than that out of the top 10 have the largest global oil reserves. So the largest oil field in the world is in Ghawar in Saudi Arabia. And actually the world's largest gas field is shared between Iran and Qatar. That's how large it is. So oil prices, what comes from oil in terms of the plastics and everything else that we've become accustomed to, it makes the region really important. The next two things that are key features of the region, first is Islam. So you find historically, the Middle East is the birthplace of Islam. This is where Islam came, is where the Prophet Muhammad Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam was born. It's from where Islam spread. And this region is still dominated by Islam and Muslims. Now, in the modern day, there's more Muslims outside the Arab world than there is in the Arab world. But nevertheless, Islam still plays a very important role in the region, despite what's going on with many of the rulers. And then the fourth feature really is you can't really talk about the Middle East without talking about the Zionist entity, Israel. The creation of Israel, the maintenance of Israel has attracted all the foreign powers. The defense of Israel is the justification for interference by many global rulers. So if you put this all together, the location in the Middle East, the energy resources, Muslims and Islam and Israel, these are the key features. And, you know, getting your head around this allows you to have a good grasp of the region.
Now, whatever you think about the Middle East, it is synonymous to Islam and Muslims. Now, we know Islam, it emerged in the 7th century. What was actually going on in the region prior to this?
So that's actually a good question, Yusuf, because for a lot of people, the Middle East begins effectively in the 7th century with the emergence of Islam. But there's always been a lot going on in the Middle East prior to this. So even when Islam emerged, it emerged in the Middle East when the Persians and the Romans, they'd been at war for a few millennia. So the Persians, obviously in Iran, their borders used to go through Iraq up to where Turkey is. The Romans from, well, the Byzantines and the Romans before them, their borders used to push up against the northern areas of the Middle East. So you find there was a constant tussle between them. Islam emerged when these two powers were still really at war with each other. And that's why when Islam came, there were already Christians in the Middle East. There were already Jews in the Middle East, because the faiths of these people had been around well before Islam came. Then obviously, Islam emerged in the 7th century, and that's become a defining feature, really, of the region.
In the modern era, how did the Middle East rise into importance?
When we look at the Middle East today, Yusuf, what you see is lots of desert. What you see is a very harsh climate. Even if you look at a population density chart of the Middle East, you find the coastal areas is where most of the main cities are, or you find the cities are along the main rivers. So you've got the Tigris, the Euphrates, you've got the Nile. Even if you look at Saudi Arabia, most of its towns are on the coastal areas. You don't find many towns in the middle of the desert. You know, desert's a harsh place to live in. You need water to survive. So although the Middle East today is known for oil, before 1900, nobody knew there was oil there. So actually, the Middle East really was quite famous from the period after the Prophet, peace be upon him, up to the modern day. It was actually famous for being quite resource poor. It was an area that was actually quite difficult for people to live in. But it became important because the Middle East became a transit point for Europeans to get to India and the Far East. So if you think about Europe, so European powers like Britain, like France, like Spain, Portugal, Belgium, how did they get to the Far East? How did they get to India? So they would go through the Mediterranean. Some of them would go around Africa, but most would go through the Mediterranean. And then once you get to the Levant area, you would have to go through over Egypt, or you'd go through the Euphrates or the Tigris. And then you'd have to go around the Red Sea over to the Indian Ocean. So having access to port facilities became really, really important. So Britain actually came to Iran in 1688. They needed ports for their ships to India. So they actually helped Iran's rulers get rid of the Portuguese. And the Brits in 1688 established a trading post at Bandar Abbas. This then allowed them to expand posts all over the Middle East, from Basra to Bahrain to Qatar. So, you know, if we're talking about the modern age, the rise of the Europeans, the transiting to India and the Far East is really where the Middle East became important for them.
If we go back a little bit before the Europeans began to arrive in the Middle East, we've already mentioned the people were Muslim, but who actually were they? What ethnicities did they consist of? How were they organized? What was the politics of the region for this European era?
So when the Prophet ﷺ came to Arabia and Islam grew as a religion and the system of the people, many people embraced Islam, and many people that weren't Muslims lived by the Islamic rules at the time. So what you find is Islam really came and took people away from their tribal identities. In fact, the period before Islam is called the Jahiliya, the period of ignorance. And it's called that because tribes would fight each other, because that's what tribes did. They didn't even know why they were fighting, but that's what they did. Islam came and it unified two tribes, and then it expanded to other tribes and it actually unified them. After the Prophet, peace be upon him, Islam and the capital of Islam moved to other areas. But what you find is before the Europeans arrived, the region was largely organized via tribes. Now, living in the desert, it made life quite harsh. It made life quite difficult. So what you find is a lot of the tribes would fight and compete with each other for resources, for water. So before the Europeans arrived, what you find was the Ottomans was where in Turkey was the capital of the Muslim territories. And they indirectly ruled over most of the Middle East. So when we say the Middle East, we say the north of the Middle East, so, you know, where modern day Syria, Iraq, Jordan is, Palestine, going all the way down the coast, and then the other way going towards where we have the Gulf today. So the Ottomans ruled, but the Ottomans were far away in Turkey. So what you find, there was a number of tribes that became quite influential. So you had the Hashemites, who rule Jordan now, and they were a tribe that was known because the Sharif of Makkah, the person who effectively was the leader of the two mosques and Makkah and Medina, the holy cities, it was from their family. So you had the Hashemite tribe. you had the Sauds, who now obviously run Saudi Arabia, and they were competing with a number of tribes in the Arabian Peninsula. So you had the Rashidis, who were in the north of modern-day Saudi Arabia. They were loyal to the Ottomans, whilst the Sauds were not loyal to the Ottomans. Then you had many of the Gulf rulers today, you know, the rulers of Kuwait, of Qatar, of Bahrain, of UAE. All of these nations today were actually tribes that all used to fight each other. And then alongside them, across the ocean, you had the Qajar dynasty in Iran that was actually in decline, really, from this period onwards. So really, the structure was tribal, and many of these tribes used to compete with each other. So naturally, whilst the Europeans came, they had to interact with some of them. And really, that came to define the modern era of the Middle East.
Now, we've got like a little bit of a timeline going here. So after this period, you mentioned that's when the Europeans started to come in. What was the role of foreign nations in the Middle East?
So really, the first time the Europeans, you know, from their perspective, they're seeing in Europe the continent, and they need to get to the other side of the world. They need to get to India, they need to get to China, they need to get to the East Indies, Indonesia, for trade purposes, for imperial purposes. So the only way to do that is to traverse the Middle East. So you find the French, the Portuguese, the Spanish, and the Brits. They all came looking for ports along the Middle East. So they would make contacts with these tribes. They would come to agreements with them. They would arm them in many, many cases. For the tribes, this was an opportunity for them to become stronger by getting outside support. So Britain was interested in the Middle East because of India. In fact, its route to India was via the Mediterranean, over the Euphrates and the Tigris, and then from the Indian Ocean to India. So for Britain, this trade route became very critical. The French, they established themselves in the Levant. So, you know, modern-day Lebanon, modern-day Syria. Their links to this region goes back to the days of the Crusades. So they needed access via the Mediterranean to the Middle East. And then eventually, you saw Russia came into the equation. Russia was trying to expand its empire from the Caspian down to the Caucasus, to Turkey, to the Middle East. And in fact, Russia has been doing this for a long time. It's always tried to get access to the Middle East via the Caucasus, via Turkey, Azerbaijan, these sort of countries. So really what you find is foreign nations had their own interests. And all of this is before oil. So really they need the transit routes. And for that, you need to make links with the different tribes in the region. And that's really how foreign nations first came around to the Middle East.
Not long after that, a very famous agreement, many people know about it, the Sykes-Picot Agreement. Can you give us a bit more information about that? How did that take place? Who was involved? And what was the aftermath of that?
So Yusuf, I said previously that 1688 was when Britain first made that agreement for a port on the Iranian coast. From that point onwards, what you find is Britain, France, eventually Russia, they came to play an increasing role in the politics of the Middle East. All of them were reaching out to different tribes. The tribes were obviously fighting each other. And what you find is as the Ottomans were declining, as the 1800s, 1900s came about, what you find was, you know, eventually an agreement was made between France and Britain. And Sykes-Picot are two people. One's a French civil servant, one's a British civil servant. And during World War One, they made this famous agreement where they carved up the Middle East. So up until this time, Yusuf, Britain saw it as its interest to keep and try and maintain the Ottomans as weak as they were. Because they felt if the Ottomans collapse, Russia will swallow some of the Middle East and the French will swallow some of it. By having the Ottomans still in place, by giving them a leg up, at least Britain still gets its privileges, but the French and the Russians don't. By 1900, Britain had concluded the Ottomans are finished. And really, they were plotting to carve up the Middle East themselves. And what the Sykes-Picot Agreement was, and it literally was two civil servants sitting around a map of the Middle East, and they drew a line from Mount Hermon in the south of Lebanon, going all the way up to Iran. So the north of that became Syria, and that went to Lebanon, and that went to France. And south of that, which became Jordan, which became Iraq, which became Saudi Arabia and the Gulf, that went to Britain. What makes this agreement interesting is the way we found out about this agreement, Yusuf, is World War One was from 1914 to 17, to 1918, sorry. And in 1917, the Russian nation collapsed. They left the war. And when the monarchy was overthrown, the foreign policy department, where the records were maintained and where the official used to sit, it was ransacked. And one of the things they found when it was ransacked was this agreement. So what it means that this plot was going on for some time. And then obviously, you know, the nations we have today in the Middle East, they go back to this era. So Jordan, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, Palestine, all of these were... What effectively Britain and France did was they awarded tribe that worked with them, that supported their interests, they gave them their own nations. So the Hashemites got their own nation, Iraq and Jordan. So the Sharif of Makkah and Medina, his sons were given two of their own country. The Sauds, who sided with Britain against the Ottomans, they got their own country, Saudi Arabia. The Gulf leaders eventually got their own countries as well. In Iran, Britain put a monarchy there. In Turkey, Britain obviously had a relationship there as well. So really, a lot of the architecture of the Middle East today, 100% of the problems today in the Middle East goes back to the carving up of this region. And that's what the Sykes-Picot Agreement was.
Now, obviously, this agreement was between Britain and France. But now, if we look at the region, it's heavily dominated by the US. How did this change take place?
So in World War One, Yusuf, you find... The reason Britain and France didn't fall to Germany was eventually due to the entry of America into World War One. America came with over 1 million troops, and as soon as the war was over, these troops went back. America didn't engage in organizing the world after World War One. Woodrow Wilson, he actually did want to organize the world. He was the one that proposed setting up the League of Nations, but Congress didn't approve it. And the American public, they were anti-America organizing the world because this leads to wars, and that's the history of Europe. As a result, as weak as France and Britain were after World War One, because there was no other powerful country to shape the world, Britain and France created the Middle East and they shaped the world. When World War II happened, Britain was in no position to go to war. The Germans began, I think they invaded Poland in 1939, and by 1941, most of Europe was under Nazi control, and they were knocking on the doors of Moscow as well. So when America entered the war on this occasion, America realized that there's a lot of oil in the Middle East. They want that. And actually, many of America's elite, they had accepted that America should play a global role. So when World War II finished, Britain and France had been consumed to such a degree that they no longer had the economic or military capability to shape the world. And so America, as we know, it put down the global liberal order, it established the United Nations, it shaped the world. So really, World War II and the fact that no bombs fell in America, most of them fell in Europe, that meant that America was in a much stronger position. So America began to shape the world. And as the Cold War was beginning, America made sure it had all of the European and the West behind it to prosecute this Cold War against the Soviet Union. So really, it was World War II. World War II had finished off these European imperial powers. And as a result, America was able to replace these countries and replace their architecture as well.
In the region, because before then, the people were all, generally speaking, Muslims. What were the circumstances that led to its creation?
Really, it's important to understand the circumstance at the time. The Europeans were anti-Semitic. That's been most of their history. They hated the Jews. They used to persecute the Jews in Europe. So the Jews, in an era of national self-determination and the emergence of new nation states, they came to see their salvation as their own nation state as well. The problem the Jews had in Europe was no one gave them any credibility. They were persecuted, and really nobody would take them seriously if they asked for their own state. So the Jews, the Zionists, began organizing themselves. And they managed to get influential Zionists like the Rothschilds to really try and argue their case with the powers of the day, which was Britain, which was America. Now, Britain was creating small artificial countries in the Middle East with France via the Sykes-Picot Agreement. So when the Zionists reached out to them, they saw it as, we can use the Zionist plight for their own objective, which is they want to create weak, small states in the Middle East. So they're all going to be dependent upon a foreign power. and this would justify the long-term intervention and presence in the region. So it's not like Britain has some care or has some sympathy for the Jews, because they treated the Jews even worse than Muslims. And that's why it's not surprising the Holocaust took place in Europe. It took place in Europe because although Germany committed the Holocaust, if you look, there's a consistent pattern on how Jews were treated. The problem obviously was, Yusuf, is in the Middle East, you had loads of Muslims. You had some Arab Jews who lived there, but they were very small in number. You had obviously Christians as well. But the Zionists that were calling for a state, these were European Jews. So the state of Israel was actually established by European Jews who then obviously came over, and they're still trying to complete their colonization and settlement in the region. The Middle East Jews were a very small number. They are discriminated against today. So these were really the circumstances. And obviously the biggest problem that occurred was many Muslims in Palestine lost their homes. They were kicked out from their homes where their ancestors lived for hundreds of years. And because they kicked them out, many of these, so the Jordan's population, I think 70% of Jordan's population is Palestinian refugees. So obviously since then, this has caused a massive problem in the region. There's been a number of wars in the region to reverse the occupation. And still today, Israel's looking for normalization with the surrounding countries. You've got this deal going on at the moment with Saudi Arabia. So you're right when you said it's the biggest cleavage in the region, because it's a foreign entity imposed upon the people. What Britain did and what America took over was that it promised a land to a people, but a land that was not theirs in the first place. So naturally, there's going to be a massive problem. And just to end on this, Yusuf, this isn't the first time this has happened. We had crusader states in the 11th century. So the European Christians established forward bases in the Middle East. These were crusader states. And they collaborated with corrupt Muslim rulers at the time in order to interfere in the region. And that's what Israel is today. Israel is a forward base for the West. It was for, you know, Britain originally, then America took over. And that's what it represents. So, you know, that's why they have to arm it. That's why they have to protect it. And that's why it remains a major cleavage in the region.
There are many more things to discuss about the Palestine and Israel issue. Maybe a podcast for the future. If we fast forward to today, we find that there's a lot of competition, or it appears like there's a lot of competition between Saudi Arabia and Iran. At the same time, there was the recent normalization deal. How much of this competition is sectarian and how much is actually political?
So I'm glad you asked this question, Yusuf, because I think a lot of this has been muddied together now. You know, sectarianism, you've got politics, you've got economics. And I think it's important we make the distinction between all of these. Before Saudi Arabia and Iran existed, obviously Iran was Persia before, what you had was a dynasty, a family that ran Iran, the Qajars. And really, if you look at the whole of Iranian history going back far, you've always had dynastic families. And what you had in the Middle East, in the Hejaz, in the Najd, was various tribes that used to fight each other. So all these tribes used to fight each other. Then they established nation states. So these nations have continued competing and fighting against each other. So what you're seeing now between Saudi and Iran isn't new. It existed even before there were nation states. Now, for Saudi and Iran to get an aura of justification, to get the people behind them, they've made use of sectarianism. So you find the Iranians say that they represent Shia Islam. So they have a right over all Shia Muslims, and they are on a mission to spread Shia Islam around the world. And then you have Saudi Arabia, who manages the two holy mosques. They are the leaders of the Sunni world, and they are in a struggle to spread Sunni Islam. So for them, Shia Islam is a threat. And for Iran, Sunni Islam is actually a threat. But this is to get justification, because what you find, both countries are quite selective of when they use sectarianism. So when it comes to Israel, when it comes to other Muslim countries, you see very little sectarianism. What you see is national interest. What you even sometimes see is Muslims versus Jews. But what you find is, you know, to say there's a sectarian issue here, it's more they are trying to use sectarianism to justify the actions that they're doing, to justify the struggle that they're actually involved in. In origin, this is a tribal struggle, competition. And because they now have their own nation states, this struggle continues in the form of their two nation states. So really what this is it's a political issue of two nations that are run by families or run by a faction who are competing with each other. and to justify what they're doing, to get this cover, they use sectarianism. So really the struggle fundamentally isn't sectarianism, because sometimes they will use economic arguments, sometimes they will use political arguments. The fact that they pick and choose shows you economy that. Really what's been the constant feature is these are tribes and factions, and they're competing with each other.
Now, if we look at some of the other nations around the Middle East, what's the position of the Gulf nations? What are they trying to do in the region? What's the role that they are playing?
So the Gulf nations, so Kuwait, Qatar, Bahrain, UAE, going down to Oman. Again, most of the rulers, all the rulers in these nations are tribes. And these are tribes that used to fight each other. They used to fight the Sauds, all of these people. And because Britain needed ports, Britain collaborated with them. And then eventually Britain even rewarded them with their own nations. But the Gulf nations play a much larger role in the region because they have oil wealth. What you find is, depending on which power backs them, you find the Gulf nations support the interests of a foreign power. So for long, you find the Gulf nation, they've supported Britain politically. But as America's grown in influence, they've actually even supported America in some of its strategies. So the Iraq War, you find, you know, America's largest America's largest airplanes take off from Qatar, which had the largest runway, Al Udeid Air Base. So you find that a lot of these Gulf leaders have used their money to buy weapons, which has helped American and foreign defense industries. You find the Gulf leaders were the ones that backed and funded the Taliban historically. So you find they play a very, very important role. You know, whichever nation has influence over the Gulf nations, they can use the Gulf nations to fund and support their Gulf. That's why you find during the Arab Spring, all of these countries supported different factions. So these countries are not independent, despite having all the wealth that they have. But really what you find, they generally support Western strategies for the world. And it really depends which countries still support Britain. Because many of the Gulf leaders' children and their families, they still go to Sandhurst in the UK. That's how Britain maintained relations with them. And we know America has for a long time been trying to remove British influence in the Middle East, and especially the Gulf states. The Iraq War, as the neocons admitted, was more or less for getting access and controlling the oil wealth of the Gulf states. So the Gulf states play a similar role to most of the Muslim rulers. You know, they act as proxy for the West, but it just depends which country they actually proxy for. That can chop and change.
Would you say Egypt is also similar to the rest of the Gulf nations?
Yes, Egypt, actually, historically, Egypt was considered the leader of the Middle East. You know, any Middle East issue, Egypt would either lead on it or Egypt had to agree to it. You look at the two-state solution, you look at the Iran-Iraq war, you look at all the regions, Egypt has historically been the leader. But since the Arab Spring in 2012, Egypt suffered from lots of economic issues. It suffered from lots of political issues. So at the moment, Egypt doesn't play a wider role because it lacks the capability. It's got too many domestic issues. But yeah, until recently, until a decade ago, Yusuf, Egypt was the political leader. You want to solve anything, any major issues, you know, you get together at Cairo, you get together at Sharm el-Sheikh. It was Egypt that was leading on regional issues.
Now, you mentioned the Arab Spring. That was 12 years ago, a long time ago. And a lot of the rulers that were there for many years, decades, have now been replaced. Have we seen a change in the Middle East? Have we seen a better Middle East since then?
It would be great, Yusuf, if I could say over a decade on from the Arab Spring, things have improved, things have got better. Unfortunately, you find that's not the case. So if you look at Syria, if you look at Libya, if you look at Yemen, these countries are a mess. You've seen civil wars, you've seen factional infighting, and then you've seen foreign powers interfere, which just made things even worse. In Egypt and Tunisia, where the leadership and the previous dictators were overthrown, you find an Islamic-minded groups came to power, but they compromised so much that they abandoned their manifesto, and eventually they were thrown out anyway. And what you find in both countries, the old guard are all back in power again anyway. So in Egypt, the military is back in power, and they're even worse than they were before. You find in a number of other countries where uprisings happen, the regimes threw money at the people, so the people don't take to the streets again. So you find today, Yusuf, things are far worse in the Middle East. In fact, Yusuf, if it wasn't for COVID, I think we would have had the regional right uprising again. In Iraq, in Iran, in Lebanon, you find there were already protests getting larger and larger against the regimes. And what the regimes did, they used the lockdown during COVID to clamp down upon the people. But you've seen in Iran, people are back on the streets. In Egypt, they're on the streets. In Lebanon, Lebanon's collapsed as a nation. So, you know, probably a good way to look at this, Yusuf, is before every earthquake, you get tremors. The Arab Spring 12 years ago was the tremor. The real earthquake has to happen yet.
There's a lot of talk about Russia and China emerging as new powers in the Middle East. Does this mean the US is actually declining in this region?
Yeah, so this gets a lot of media coverage, Yusuf. Every move China and Russia seem to be making gets lots of attention. And that's why many people are saying America's in decline. So Russia's intervention in Syria in 2015 is saving of Bashar al-Assad's regime. Russia's involvement now in Libya, many people are interpreting this as Russia is gaining more and more influence in the Middle East whilst America's in decline. On the flip side, you've got Iran, you've got China making lots of agreements with Middle Eastern countries. So Saudi Arabia's largest oil customer is no longer America, it's now China. China's recently made some very large economic, political, military agreements with Iran. So both China and Russia get a lot of media coverage. However, Yusuf, if we look at the region's key issues, Palestine, two-state solution, Syria, you look at Libya, you look at what's going on in Egypt, you look at what's going on in Yemen. What are China and Russia saying? In fact, China and Russia are not even at the negotiating table. So you find that Russia and China are very loud in what they do. But what you find, the two-state solution is the American solution. Syria, despite everything that's happened, really, until America doesn't sit down and impose, nothing's finished. We're now Yemen now. America has been providing significant support to Saudi Arabia. So you find, Yusuf, on the key regional issues, China and Russia have no say. In fact, they're not even at the table on where these agreements are going to be made. But that really shows you that despite economic relations and military relations, really both countries have little say, which means little influence over the key issues of the day. So definitely this is a case of where they're shouting louder than what they're really doing.
Now, final question for you. So with all that we've discussed, what are the key long-term trends that you see in the Middle East?
Okay, so three key trends really, Yusuf, in the long run. Population growth, the position of fossil fuels going forward, and the gap between the people and the rulers. The population in the Middle East, I think now, is above 300 million. Egypt, Sudan, Algeria, and Yemen are considered some of the largest populated countries in the Middle East. And the population of these countries and the wider Middle East is only going up. Whilst in many countries around the world, especially in the West, population is declining, in the Middle East, you find the populations are increasing. So what that means, Yusuf, is the governments in these countries need to produce more jobs, they need to sort the economy out, they need to create more housing, they need to create more schools. And these are areas there's no long-term plans for in this country. In fact, in Egypt, the ruler keeps saying that we should eat less because we're eating too much. So really, if populations are going to go up, then the stability of the regimes are going to remain in question. So, you know, that's something to watch going forward. Fossil fuels. So we've seen with Saudi Arabia already, you know, the era of lots of fossil fuel and lots of fossil fuel wealth. Saudi's now concluded that the days are numbered. I mean, we're talking 40, 50 years away. But this region has relied on oil and gas wealth for a very long time. These are countries that don't have taxes. These are countries where water is more expensive than oil. So with the whole green push around the world, with the future of fossil fuels now in question, the strategic resource the Middle East has relied upon, it may not be as strategic going forward as it is today. So this will have a major impact. I mean, if you look at countries like Saudi and the Gulf states, you know, everything is based on oil, the fact that it's the most strategic commodity in the world. But as we move to more green tech, as we move to more energy efficient tech, the use of fossil fuels may start to decline, which will have a major impact on the economies of these countries. And then finally, Yusuf, you know, we saw with the Abraham Accords, and we've seen on a whole host of other issues, that there's a big gap between the sentiments of the people and the sentiments of the rulers. Where the rulers are and where the people are, there's a massive gap in between. And when the rulers are not representing the people, they eventually get overthrown. So although the rulers managed to survive, or most of them managed to survive the Arab Spring in 2012, what you find, the gap today is way bigger compared to recent history. So this doesn't bode well for the regimes. It doesn't bode well for the stability of the regime. It doesn't bode well for the future of the region. So all three of these trends, Yusuf, are going to put significant strain on the rulers who only know the iron fist to remain in power. So again, these are probably trends to watch for the medium to long term due to the impact they will possibly have.
Thank you for your time today, Adnan. A very interesting topic. We probably have a lot more to discuss about these countries. If you want to learn more about the issues we've raised today, please check out our website, www.thegeopolitics.com, all one word. You can also learn more on many other issues by accessing our website, where you'll find comprehensive insights, analysis, articles, and deep dives. I'm Yusuf. Thank you for listening.